Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. What makes us make those split-second decisions we do? Is it instantaneous calculation, history and experience, intuition, or folly? Our next guest is Maria Konnikova. She's a New York Times best-selling author, a psychologist, and someone who was so interested in things like the effects of hot and cool emotional states on self-control, ability, and decision-making, especially under risk and uncertainty, that over a year, she decided to learn how to play poker and become a professional poker player. She parlayed this strong grasp of the science of human decision-making and, oh, a woeful ignorance of cards into a life-changing run as now a professional poker player. Maria Konnikova is the author of bestsellers Mastermind and The Confidence Game, and her new book is called The Biggest Bluff: How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. Maria Konnikova, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn. It's always a pleasure.
So when I saw the science of decision making, I thought that's someone we want to talk to here on Cool Science Radio. Tell us, first of all, why you decided to go so deeply into a game like poker that you became a professional just to figure out and further study the science of decision making.
That's a question for the ages. And that wasn't actually the plan. I was never planning to become a professional poker player. Originally, this was going to be a year-long project where I just learned the game and used it as a lens to study decision-making. But of course, one of the things about decision-making is it's filled with uncertainty and unpredictability. And the thing about the future is it's unknowable because it's the future. So I had no idea what was going to happen. I didn't know that I would end up actually growing to love and enjoy this game that I had no awareness of beforehand. I mean, literally, I didn't know how many cards were in a deck when I started this project. I didn't know that I would actually have a talent for it, that I would get good, that I would start winning things, and that it would lead me in an entirely new direction. What I did know, and the reason I picked up poker to begin with, was that poker would offer me a lens into a lot of the questions that I'd been struggling with for a long time, both when I was at Columbia doing my research in psychology as a graduate student, and then afterwards in my personal life, which was just the role that chance plays in our lives and how we can learn the difference between skill and chance, the things that are within our purview to control and the things that are outside it. Where does our decision making, so to speak, end, and just uncertainty and variance and the outside world begin? It seems like an easy question to answer, but it's not, because the world is so noisy and there's so many factors out there. And one of the things that I'd found in my psychology work was that over and over, people would overestimate the degree of control that they had over decisions and underestimate the environment and chance and what was going on outside of them. And I was introduced to poker by game theory, by John von Neumann, the father of game theory, in his book, The Theory of Games. So, like I said, I didn't know anything about it, but I read that von Neumann was not just a poker player, but that poker had actually inspired game theory, which is one of the crucial decision-making theories of the 20th century. And he made a very strong case that poker was a really wonderful lens through which to examine strategic decision-making in life, because both poker and life are games of incomplete information, games where there are things that I know, things that you know, things that we both know, and we have to make decisions knowing that we don't know everything. We have to try to find as much information as we get, as we can, gain an informational advantage. But at the end of the day, all we can do is put ourselves in a position to win, so to speak, in a position to be a favorite, and the rest isn't up to us. This was really interesting to me because it seemed to offer a way into a topic that is very abstract. And so I started reading about poker and something clicked. I thought, this is going to be my new book. I want to learn this game. I want to find someone very good to teach me, because one of the things we know about learning is it's always good to have a smart mentor. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to, you know, use this journey as a way of exploring chance and uncertainty in life. And like I said, I had no idea where it would take me. I didn't plan on becoming a professional poker player. All of those things just kind of happened along the way.
Tell us about when you approached one of the top poker players in the world to say that he should be your mentor.
I ended up lucking out so much. It's not even funny. Talk about luck, right? I didn't even realize what I was doing. Because I was such a neophyte, all I could really do was Google, you know, best poker players in the world. There was a name that I kept seeing over and over and over, Eric Seidel. And he, at the time, had the greatest amount of lifetime earnings of all players. He doesn't anymore, but that list changes all the time. And he'd been around since the 80s and winning since the 80s. And I couldn't find anyone else like that who had that sort of longevity. It seemed that a lot of the poker stars would burn bright and then burn out. And he just was steady and kept going and kept winning. And I thought, huh, I can probably learn from that. What I didn't know was that he'd never taken on any students before in his life. And so that probably would have given me pause. I didn't know just how self-effacing and humble he was. One of the first things that he asked me when I approached him was, I'm not actually going to be in this book, am I? Which made me not laugh, but be very sheepish because he ended up being the heart and center of the book. But I knew that I wanted to do my best to try to convince him. And so my pitch was very different. I think the reason he agreed was that I wasn't a poker player. I was a writer. I was a psychologist. And to him, it was a test of his philosophy. Right now, we see a battle in poker that's playing out in all sorts of walks of life. I mean, even in writing and literature, quantification versus the qualification of things, right? The psychological versus the mathematical. Can we use a softer approach as opposed to just hard math, hard numbers? And as I said, you see this in just everywhere. You see algorithms and models and big data, and that's the ascendant way of thinking right now. In poker, Eric comes from an older school, a more psychological, human decision-making school. And I think he was curious to see whether that could succeed today, whether I could, with my psychology background, gain an edge with no real mathematical background. My last math class was in high school. So I think that to him that it was a very interesting challenge. And I tried to push the psychology angle from the beginning. I mean, I came prepared with printouts of psychology studies that, as far as I knew, had never made it out of academia about poker to try to show him that I could add some value to this relationship as well, that there were things that psychologists could teach him about his game.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Maria Konnikova, who has written a fascinating book, The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. And Maria, as you write in your book, there are Caltech PhDs lining these tables. They have printouts of stats. They rarely finish a sentence without saying GTO, game theory optimal, or EV, positive expected value. As you've gotten into this and you've learned a lot more about this, what are your current thoughts on the quantitative versus the qualitative?
I think that you need both. And I think that anyone who says otherwise is leaving a lot on the table. There are people who believe that math is all you need and that all of the psychology is just nonsense. And we don't need any of that. As long as we have our correct strategy, we can play. And that's true as far as it goes. You're not going to get into too much trouble if you do that. But you're also not going to win the maximum amount. You're not going to play your best game. And you're never going to be a truly great player. And there are also the people on the other side who say, oh, we don't need any of that math. That's crazy. Those guys, we'll leave it to them. It's all about people. It's all about reads. I trust my gut. I trust my intuition. And that also will lead to shortcomings, because that's fine as far as it goes, but you do need to understand the mathematics. And you also need to understand that you can't actually trust your gut. Our gut is not a trustworthy guide, and we should actually be getting used to not following our gut and to instead following our brain. I mean, why in the world would you listen to your stomach over your head? And yet people say they want to do that all the time. So I think that the conclusion I've come to is that you absolutely need both. You need to figure out what your strength is, and that's where you're going to focus. And then you're going to round it out with the other stuff. So my strength is still psychology. It always will be. And so to me, that's my main edge. So that's the place where I can gain the most value. That said, I've had to dive into the math, and I've had to get all of this new software, these solvers that give you your game theory optimal solutions, and try to figure out how to incorporate that into my thinking, if for nothing else than to understand the Caltech PhDs, to see where they're coming from. I know I'll never be able to beat them at that game. I know I'll never know exactly, you know, that I'm supposed to play these two cards 17.2% of the time like this. I know I'm not going to know that. And so instead, I can at least just try to understand that approach enough that I can take some things from it to supplement my approach, which is always going to be more psychological. For those guys, I think the best of them, for them, the math is the strong suit. And so, yes, they know exactly what they're supposed to do, but the best of them are also incredibly observant. They pay attention to people. They pay attention to patterns. They do what I do, and they might not do it quite as much, but they do use it as well in order to see, okay, is it smart for me to follow my game theory optimal strategy right now? Or do I need to deviate? Is something else happening at the table? Should I be taking in information that's telling me that it's time to change my mind a little bit? One of the things that my mentor, Eric Seidel, told me very early on in our coaching relationship, which really has stuck with me and has become a sort of life motto. I think it's so important, not just in poker, but in everything, was one very pithy phrase: less certainty, more inquiry. I mean, how beautiful is that? It's a guiding motto for life. And it's a way to combat overconfidence. Too much certainty is the death of you when it comes to learning, when it comes to growing, when it comes to improving, when it comes to decision-making. So he's urging this open-minded approach, this curiosity, this way of looking at everything with a willingness to change. And a lot of the mathematical guys don't do that. They say, no, this is the way you play this hand. This is what you're supposed to do here. My algorithm makes me certain. And you see that not just in poker. And I think that that's a very dangerous certainty to have.
The human condition is it's just bizarre. I mean, you write in your book, and I just find this fascinating. Our primal selves are hardwired by experience and hot emotion, which distorts and limits our views of things, sometimes magnifying threats, sometimes magnifying opportunities. There's always a T-Rex lurking around the corner, and we're one leprechaun stumble from a pot of gold. It's amazing we can even do our day-to-day work with this reptilian brain of ours.
That's true. It's true. I mean, one of the things that poker is so very good at is rectifying one of the fundamental, I'm not going to call it a flaw because I don't think we have flaws in our brains, but one of the fundamental shortcomings of the way that our neural wiring has evolved. And that's our inability to understand statistics, to grasp probabilities. And it comes from something very basic and something that was very, very powerful way back when, which is that we learn from experience. We learn from doing. We learn viscerally. We don't learn well when someone else tells us something. And most probabilities are, you know, people saying something like, oh, you have a 20% chance of this or a 10% chance of that. And we say, yeah, yeah, whatever. And what we're actually going to pay attention to is, has it happened to me? Do I know someone to whom it's happened? If so, it's going to loom large. And if not, I'm just going to dismiss it. I mean, I think that this is particularly relevant right now as we're going through a pandemic, and you can really see how this inability to grasp percentages, probabilities, statistics, how it's hurting the world and how people are really just unable to wrap their mind around certain things. And in the past, this was very, very useful. So if you're the type of person who, you know, went berry picking in the morning and there was a big lion there and you ran away and you said, okay, the lion, never going back there. And someone else said, well, you know, statistically speaking, it's likely that that lion will never be back there again. Well, that person might get eaten by the lion and you're going to be fine. So I see why our brains are not very good at it, but it's a major problem right now. Poker actually remedies it. Poker forces you to understand probabilities on a very different level because you actually, for once in your life, experience them correctly because you're playing hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of hands and you're sampling things over and over and over and getting immediate feedback. So you start to feel what 1% feels like and you realize that 1% is actually a lot. This was a major realization for me. Before I was like, 1%, 2%, whatever. No, it's huge. I would, you know, I would kill for a 1% edge, 1% more. Yes, please give it to me. And we really don't understand just how often 1% happens and how often these things, how big they actually are. One of the most interesting experiences I've had during this whole time with COVID is very early on in February, where I was looking at social media. And I have a lot of, my Twitter feed is divided into lists. I have a psychology list, I have a poker list, and this and that. And the first people to sound the alarm and to say, this is going to be bad. We actually need to be paying attention. This looks like an exponential growth curve. We need to be acting now. We're the poker players and not the psychologists, not the people with PhDs in decision making. They were the people who actually understood probabilities, the poker players.
You know, when you look at how the government and the healthcare organizations reacted to COVID in the beginning, based on limited data, but looking at these models, I suppose their reaction and their decision making was based on predictability that you, as you say, you can model from poker. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to give. Let me walk that back. I'm happy to blame people. But I understand that it's politics, that there are lots of considerations, but I do think that we had a lot of the data much earlier than people acted on it because humans don't want to act in the face of uncertainty and ambiguity. Ambiguity is also an incredibly important part here because at the beginning, we didn't even know what some of the probabilities were. So it wasn't just uncertainty. It was also this ambiguous nature. You didn't know quite how bad. You didn't know quite what the fatality rate. You didn't know quite what this was or what that was. But we did have some numbers, and those numbers were a cause for concern. And I mean, basically in mid-February or late February, I flew home, canceled the rest of my travel plans and didn't leave. And this was before lockdowns and anything else because it was clear to me what was happening. And I think that it was clear to a lot of people even earlier than that. And there was a lot of myopia, which actually goes to the heart of why a lot of decision-making at higher levels is difficult. Because we are not objective decision makers. We're emotional decision makers. We're egotistical decision makers. We let a lot of other considerations and not just the numbers play into our decisions, especially when we're in public positions and positions of power. In this particular case, that it was actually playing with people's lives. But I think a lot of times politicians care more about political futures and don't realize that the two things are very closely aligned. So yes, I think the data were there. Yes, I think they were probably very difficult to interpret. And yes, I also want to be careful because right now we're talking from the future and hindsight bias is something that's very, very strong. And so it's very easy to impose what we know now on what we know back then. That said, there were voices screaming in February. So there were people who clearly understood what was going on.
Mm. We're speaking with Maria Konnikova. She is a best-selling author of Mastermind and The Confidence Game. And she's now back with a book about her life as a professional poker player, of all things. It's called The Biggest Bluff. I'm wondering, Maria, you know, when you talk about gut versus brain, you know, intuition versus statistical analysis or predictability, probability, how has your experience as a professional poker player transferred into your daily life in terms of decisions that you make on a daily basis that previously you may have thought were just your intuition at work?
Yeah, poker has definitely made me so much more aware of the necessity for precision in my decision making, of what it means to think probabilistically. I mean, I've now started saying things like, well, you know, I'm 65% certain that I'll be able to do this, or, oh, sure, you know, I'll be there with 80% certainty. And people look at me like I'm totally crazy. But I think it's very helpful because it forces you to say, oh, wait, less certainty, more inquiry. You have to realize that you can't just give these grandiose statements. It's made me, I think, a lot more humble in the types of things that I'm willing to say. It's a really good way to tame overconfidence and things like, oh yeah, this is for sure going to happen. Oh yeah, this is definitely not going to happen. You stop making those absolutes because you start realizing that absolutes simply do not exist. And that's something that I've taken into every single decision that I make in life. And I look for the uncertainty. I try to figure out, okay, how do I minimize it? How do I gain an informational edge? How do I put myself in a position where I'm in the best place to make this decision? And how do I become comfortable knowing that the outcome might still be against me? Poker is a very strong tool for learning to separate the actual process of making a decision from the outcome itself. You learn that those two things are not one and the same. All you can do is make the best decision you can with the information you have. And then the outcome is going to be what it will be because there is no such thing as 100% certainty. And so you might get your money in, so to speak, in real life as a 98% favorite. And those 2% are going to happen. And as we've already discussed, 2% is a lot. And so you will find yourself in a situation where you made the right decision, you went through the right process, and it doesn't work out. And you have to learn the ability to not focus on that, to just move past the outcome and say, okay, at least I made the right decision. If I keep making the right decision, I'm going to, in the end up far better off. And if I followed my gut and my gut led to the right outcome, but my gut was actually the wrong decision process, that doesn't mean I should now follow my gut always, because that means in the long run, I'm actually going to lose out. That means that I got lucky. And I need to acknowledge that. And by the way, sometimes our gut is right. What we know from psychology is that we have both false and true intuitions, and we are about 50-50 at being able to figure out which is which. So we have no clue. We have no ability to distinguish the accurate from the inaccurate. And so what I would say to those people listening who say, well, I'm a very intuitive person, I want to follow my gut, I'll say, fine, but only do it if this is an area where you're an expert and your intuition is actually expertise. And if it's something that you've done for your whole life, for 10 years, you've been in this situation over and over and over, and you think of it as intuition, it's actually not. It's actually expertise that you don't necessarily have conscious access to how you came to this conclusion. That's the only way to have accurate quote-unquote intuition when it's not intuition. Otherwise, our gut really can't be trusted. So I would not go there.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Maria. This has been a fascinating conversation, and we love the book and we wish you continued success with it. Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.